A lot of money with the oil, and you would have had assets, and to the victor belonged the spoils, and all of that. But forget that.
Okay.
So that might be very instructive, Jody Vittori. You're a former military soldier. When looking at what President Trump's intentions are for Afghanistan right now, the New York Times reporting Trump is being pressured by a billionaire financier and a chemical executive to escalate the U.S. war in Afghanistan in a bid to exploit Afghanistan's mineral wealth. Can you explain what you found?
Sure. It's a troubling parallel to the 2012 reports that you just noted out when it comes to Iraq and oil. In the case of Afghanistan, reports this morning that President Trump is deeply troubled, that he acknowledges that the United States is not winning in Afghanistan. He doesn't like the strategy that his generals have given him from his national security staff. And for some reason, he has leaned towards this sort of vague plan put forward by the head of the private security company, DynCorp, Steven Feinberg, who is a major campaign contributor to the Trump campaign, that somehow the United States would come in, DynCorp would send in their private security forces that would somehow control these mining areas, including areas with the mineral lithium in it, which is important for our cell phone batteries and so forth. And somehow extract that, secure it so that other companies could extract that. And it's unclear, apparently, take that money to pay back the United States for the invasion of Afghanistan. Obviously troubling on a conflict of interest level, an ethics level, human rights, social level, and frankly, it's just completely impractical as well.
Kathy Kelly, when you hear this and read this piece in the Times about exploiting Afghanistan for its mineral wealth, and hearing the previous comment about Trump, even if he says he was opposed to the war in Iraq, once you're there, take their oil. Your thoughts?
I think it's repugnant.
Let's get Kathy Kelly's response and then yours, Jody.
Well, that it's repugnant for the United States to believe that we somehow should be able to subordinate the rights and the hopes and the possibilities for another country to serve our national interest. We have no right whatsoever to take over resources in Afghanistan, and we've already caused so much death and destruction. We should be paying reparations for that.
And Jody Vittori, can you talk about the mineral industry and who's currently benefiting from it in Afghanistan in the midst of this longest war in U.S. history?
Certainly. In 2010, the U.S. Geologic Survey estimated that Afghanistan at the time had up to $1 trillion in minerals in reserve under the ground there. Not all of that would be able to be pulled out economically, and that was at a time when these mineral prices were at their high point. That estimate is certainly not accurate now. Afghanistan is awash in minerals. Its geography is incredible when it comes to minerals and possibly natural gas as well. But right now, those who are benefiting seem to be primarily groups like the Taliban and groups like the various warlords and corrupt politicians in the country. What we don't see is the Afghan people normally getting a benefit from this mining. There is actually a tremendous amount of mining in Afghanistan. The German development agency, GIZ, estimates that about 3 to 6% of the population is involved in mining or its upstream or downstream activities. And yet, at the same time, a lot of that is really going to the hands of nefarious characters. The United Nations has estimated that after narcotics trafficking, the second largest source of revenue for the Taliban is illegal mining and quarrying in Afghanistan. And Global Witness has done reports, for example, on the role that lapis plays both in the hands of illegal armed groups, various corrupt officials and patronage networks, and the Taliban itself. So it's very, very troubling in the country.
This is part one of our discussion. We'll post the rest at democracynow.org. Jody Vittori, thanks for joining us from Global Witness on Afghanistan policy, formerly served in South Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places. And Kathy Kelly, thanks for joining us as well. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:03. Thank you.
I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a 2-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
Tune in to KBOO Saturday morning at 9 a.m. for our annual live broadcast from Pickathon. From 9 a.m. to noon, we'll be live at the festival with special appearances from Anna and Elizabeth, Dory Freeman, and Billy Strings. Again, that's KBOO at the Pickathon, Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon, here on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as KBOO Night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast 22nd and Clinton in Portland. Schedule an info at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Governor Kate Brown has declared a state of emergency due to the wildfires that are burning throughout the Pacific Northwest.
Charges have been dropped against Lewis Hunter after his arrest at a Minnesota protest last July.
Linn County welcomes the decades-long running Mother Earth Fair this weekend, where you can learn a plethora of information on earthy living.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, August 3rd, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Cryptosporidium. It's a word you don't often hear, and hopefully soon you'll be hearing about it even less. Crypto is a nasty little parasite that can be found in some sources of drinking water and is a leading cause of waterborne disease among humans. While the city of Portland does remain in compliance with state and federal rules concerning water treatment, the city council has recently directed the Water Bureau to design and construct an additional filtration facility. This comes after a hearing that included presentations from several sources, including Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Paul Lewis, concerning crypto. However, an article recently published on PortlandOregon.gov states that the water is still just fine to drink and continues to be tested for the nasty little bug.
Small business lending has been on the decline since 2007, particularly for people of color. But Senator Wyden thinks he may have a solution. He, along with a few other Democrat constituents, is urging the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to compel banks to not only collect information pertaining to potential barriers affecting minority small business owners, but publish this information as well. The Dodd-Frank Act already requires demographics information to be collected and made available to small businesses. But Senator Wyden doesn't think that this is enough, and he is hoping that making this new information available will hopefully shed some much-needed transparency on the issue and help local businesses in the near future.
Portland City Council voted unanimously 5-0 yesterday to appeal a decision by Oregon's Land Use Board of Appeals, familiarly known as LUBA, that found Portland's fossil fuel terminal zoning restrictions unconstitutional. The Oregon State Court of Appeals will hear appeals on the case. Several commissioners noted that LUBA's ruling came from a single LUBA board member, with the two of the three voting members of LUBA recusing themselves from the decision. Commissioners cited a need for the Oregon Court of Appeals to provide more clarity over the city's authority to protect the health and safety of residents, as well as the health of the environment. In speaking about his vote in favor of the appeal, Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "The community expects us to defend policy," end quote. Members of the Portland Business Alliance began aligning with decision makers in the fossil fuel industry in the past year in order to challenge the previous LUBA ruling restricting the zoning pertaining to fossil fuel interests. Cities cannot directly or unilaterally ban fossil fuels from being shipped, used, or transported, but cities challenge policy and enact local laws that place limits on the use of fuel if it affects the environment. It can take upwards of 6 weeks to file with LUBA, and the Oregon Court of Appeals could be responding to the calls for clarification within the next 2 months.
Central City Concern went ahead with the destruction of a grove of old-growth Douglas fir trees today in southeast Portland. Despite the concerns of the neighbors and environmental groups, the trees cut down without any notice given to the neighbors at 12647 Southeast Stark. All of the dozen or so trees that were hauled away appeared well over 100 years old, with trunks well beyond the 36-inch width required by the city to designate them as heritage trees.
Thank you.
keep as many as possible. But it just it wasn't possible to create the affordable housing units that neighborhood needs. Sure. I can tell you though that there's going to be less transient activity on the property. I think that it's going to really help the neighborhood clean up the area a bit. I know there's been a lot of drug use on the property and things like
is
that.
Is this about the thing, the old growth?
Yeah.
Last year, during Donald Trump's campaign trail, Trump indicated the costs associated with Air Force One were, quote, out of control. Recently, the Air Force came up with a possible solution. It appears that senior Air Force officials have acquired some older, cheaper Boeing 747s in Russia. The Air Force is planning to purchase a pair of jets that were abandoned.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lyon.
That were abandoned when a Russian airline declared bankruptcy. Now, while these new jets will cut down on the price of the jets themselves, it's worth noting that the president's jet does require considerable customization. A $170 million contract has been awarded to Boeing to design these planes.
If you are a fan of the Oregon coast and enjoy local music, you're in luck. On the 23rd of September, you will have the opportunity to experience the first annual Stackstock, a one-day music festival at Cannon Beach that's near, you guessed it, the famous Haystack Rock. Musical lineup includes the Decemberists, the Edna Vasquez Trio, Cardioid and Wonderly, and many more talented acts.
It looks like the Canadian wildfires have lit a match in the Pacific Northwest. Governor Kate Brown has declared a state of emergency here in Oregon on Wednesday due to the record-breaking heat, continuing hot weather, and forecasts of thunderstorms. Multiple fires have been burning throughout the state, from the Spruce Lake Fire near Crater Lake to the Blanket Fire near Prospect, Oregon. Both fires are only at about 5% contained. Crews have been working to contain the fires as they threaten homes and other structures. Popular hiking locations have closed. Access to their trails and parks, such as Jefferson Trail and Park, Eagle Creek Park, and Pacific Crest Trail. This is another reminder to limit outdoor activities with exposure to the heat, such as hiking, as temperatures continue to hike up in the region.
We'd like to wish a happy birthday to Leo, the new son of Tristan Reese and Biff Chaplow. Tristan, a 34-year-old transgender man, is elated to have given birth to the healthy baby, Leo saying, I'm a narrow person and he's a big baby, which is not an exaggeration. Leo rang in at a whopping 9 pounds and 6 ounces. The couple states that they have received a lot of positive support on their Facebook profiles, although some folks haven't been quite as accepting. In an interview with Inside Edition, Tristan stated that some folks have gone so far as to wish the baby hadn't made it through the pregnancy, saying, quote, a dead baby is better than growing up in their family, end quote. Many transgendered folks don't choose surgery as a part of their transformation. In this case, Tristan decided that hormone treatment alone was enough for him to feel he was a part of the world, although he did not stop taking testosterone treatments during the pregnancy. Tristan and Biff have two adopted daughters who are both very excited to have a brand new younger brother.
Now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections.
And this is Climate Connections.
I was thinking...
Most of us take running water for granted, but it comes at a cost, and that cost is growing. Ed Osan, senior policy analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council, says residential water and wastewater rates have been rising for years, and climate change is making it worse.
While affordability may not have been an issue 20 or 25 years ago, we're just in a different place right now.
For one thing, many communities have aging water systems that are not prepared to handle the droughts, floods, and extreme storms that are becoming more common. Renovating and repairing these systems is expensive, and the cost trickles down to consumers. Shortages are also a concern. Rising sea levels threaten coastal freshwater supplies, and warmer, drier weather means lawns get watered more often, increasing demand for shrinking water supplies. All this affects the cost. As prices rise, some customers may struggle to pay for the water they need.
Both states and utilities should take a clear-eyed look at the situation and take steps to ensure that water remains affordable for the most disadvantaged consumers.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Gray wolves from the Great Lakes region have won a battle to stay on the endangered species list. With populations growing in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and surrounding areas, the Department of Interior has removed the Great Lakes region gray wolf segment from the endangered species list in 2012, thus opening up a hunting season, the first in that region in over four decades. The Court of Appeals judged that the department is not able to remove just one segment of an endangered species list without viewing the condition of the species as a whole. The initial removal of the Great Lakes wolf populations was due to an Obama-era decision to hand over the decision-making processes to the state-level management. Jonathan Lavorne, the senior vice president of the Humane Society, stated that, quote, "We are pleased that the court has recognized that the basis for the delisting decision was flawed and would stop wolf recovery in its tracks," end quote. There are currently 2,800 wolves living in the Great Lakes region.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Calling it a way to reduce fractionalization of tribal lands, the U.S. Interior Department announced this week that it is scaling back the land buyback program. The buyback started in 2013 under then-President Barack Obama to consolidate tribal lands by allowing tribes to purchase sections from willing sellers. The program relied on nearly $2 billion set aside from the Cobell settlement. The announcement cites feedback from tribal leaders and landowners as reasons behind the change. The announcement says the department leadership will determine how best to allocate the remaining $540 million earmarked for the program. The man charged in the abduction and murder of an 11-year-old Navajo girl entered a guilty plea Tuesday in federal court in New Mexico. 28-year-old Tom Begay admits to the six counts stemming from the death of Ashlyn Mike in May of last year. The plea includes charges Begay abducted the girl's brother, who managed to escape unharmed. Begay initially pleaded not guilty. A release by the U.S. Department of Justice says this week's plea agreement requires a mandatory life sentence with no possibility of release. Family members and others filled the U.S. District Courtroom for the hearing. Afterwards, the girl's father, Gary Mike, told reporters that Begay finally admitted to what he and others already knew was true. In a written statement, Navajo Nation President Russell Begay said his community has suffered pain since the crime occurred and that the plea agreement is one step forward in healing. The crime prompted a review of Amber Alert systems designed to notify the public when a child is abducted. In this case, the notification went out hours after the abduction report. Last month, the Navajo Nation voted to support a congressional measure to expand the Amber Alert system to reservations. Chiefs from Canada's largest Native organization have passed a resolution calling for changes to the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the chiefs would not go so far as to support a call to replace the current commissioners.
The chiefs of the Assembly of First Nations were gathered in Regina for their annual summer meeting, and the issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls was high on their agenda, specifically whether to endorse growing calls for a hard reset of the Commission of Inquiry. Some argued that to do that, there might not even be another inquiry, or it could take a couple of years to get off the ground. And there were arguments that some families have already given testimony during the inquiry's first hearing. The Assembly also heard from people who want a complete reset of the inquiry, people like Hilda Anderson Pierce, who lost family members to violence.
You failed in communications. You failed to build trust. You failed to build relationships with families. So for me, I stand here today and I ask the commissioners to respectively step down.
Debate among the chiefs continued for nearly 2 hours, some saying Canada's Indigenous people can't afford another delay, adding that although the process is flawed, they can still work together to fix it. Others said to remove the commissioners would be to kill the inquiry. But in the end, the chiefs from the country's most powerful First Nations organization rejected the call for the Prime Minister to replace the commissioners. But they did support calling for changes, including some form of reset and rethinking the Commission's mandate and process. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Supreme Court could take up a water rights case involving the Agua Caliente Band of Kaweah Indians this fall. The Wall Street Journal reports the years-long case involving the small California tribe could affect water rights throughout the western United States. The tribe won a federal appeals court ruling in March in their argument to gain more control over management of the aquifer below tribal land. They say the public water agencies in charge of the water have mismanaged it. The aquifer helped drive development in California's Coachella Valley, including the city of Palm Springs. The paper notes tribes have won legal water rights challenges in the past, but the issue is less settled when it comes to groundwater. Police on Maui, Hawaii, arrested a half dozen protesters Tuesday during a blockade to stop trucks hauling equipment for a telescope under construction. Among other things, the trucks were carrying the 4-meter diameter mirror for the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope under construction on top of Haleakala, the tallest summit on Maui. The mountain is considered sacred by Native Hawaiians. The Honolulu Star-Advertiser reports those arrested face charges of disorderly conduct, obstructing a highway, and failing to obey a police officer. After officers cleared the road, the convoy of trucks passed through and made it to their destination. Construction on the telescope started in 2012 and is scheduled to be complete in 2019. Once finished, it will be the largest telescope in the world. An external review has been released into allegations by several indigenous women who claim they were coerced into being sterilized after giving birth. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the review found that the women clearly felt stressed and under undue duress.
The 56-page review was compiled over 6 months. It included interviews with 7 indigenous women, healthcare providers from the Saskatoon Health Region, where the sterilizations are alleged to have taken place, and members of the Ministry of Child and Family Services. It found that the women felt stressed from being coerced into having a tubal ligation while in labor. That's a procedure in which a woman's fallopian tubes are clamped or severed, considered a permanent method of birth control. The report says most of the women did not understand that the procedure was permanent. It concluded local health authorities did not serve the women's needs and impacted their womanhood, their mental health, self-esteem, and their relationships. Bobby Cameron is a chief representing 74 First Nations in Saskatchewan. He says he didn't need to read the report to know what it was going to say.
They're going to say what we've known all along, that the doctors and the nurses bullied and they forced our First Nations woman to get that procedure done against their will.
At a news conference, the vice president of the Regional Health Authority apologized to the women. At one point, she was in tears as she said she's sorry for what the women experienced under the health authority's care and that they were not treated with respect, compassion, and support. And she acknowledged that racism exists within the healthcare system. Health authorities say they will take guidance from Indigenous elders and will discuss further action with government agencies in the coming weeks. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An employee of the Washington, D.C. office of the Navajo Nation is charged for bringing a loaded handgun onto the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. The Washington Post reports Capitol Police arrested Kimberly Barber after they found the firearm in a suitcase she brought through a security entrance of the Cannon House office building. Barber told police she had no knowledge the gun was there. The paper reports the gun belonged to a Navajo Nation police officer who left it in a hotel room. Barber's boss asked her to bring the suitcase, not knowing the gun was in there. A utility company plans to challenge the Navajo Nation's appeals court win that Nation officials view as a victory for tribal sovereignty. The case involves the Public Service Company of New Mexico's effort to run power lines across the Navajo Nation. Tribal officials fought the plan and won a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. PNM filed a motion to stay that decision last week while it pursues an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp is urging the Attorney General to approve federal reimbursements for law enforcement costs during the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. In a letter to Jeff Sessions this week, the Democrat says state and local law enforcement officials performed, quote, admirably under immense pressure and scrutiny. She blames the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the extended length of the protests, saying the agency failed to make a timely decision on the permit for the pipeline company to move ahead. She also says the Army Corps neglected to limit the size of the protest camp on their land. She tells the Attorney General the law enforcement agencies deserve to recover at least part of the estimated $40 million in additional costs they incurred during the months of protests. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
I thought we were going.
Charges have been dropped against Lewis Hunter, the cousin of the late Philando Castile. Hunter had been arrested at a protest in St. Paul, Minnesota last July, protesting the killing of his cousin by a police officer. Castile's killing sparked nationwide protest as his girlfriend live streamed the aftermath of the shooting live on Facebook, and their 4-year-old daughter was in the back seat. In the days following the killing, Protesters took to the streets in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and many other cities. One of the protesters was Castile's cousin, Louis Hunter, who was arrested and charged with felony riot. Just yesterday, after months of organizing and publicity around his case, the charges were dropped. Many people still face charges from a summer full of protests following Castile's killing last July. And a quick apology, that was actually Native News. Jim Hightower will be on in a little bit.
The governors of many states are boldly stepping forward these days to stop grassroots democracy. Yes, noting that local citizens and officials have been passing local laws to govern themselves, a flock of right-wing governors are asserting an autocratic power called state preemption to overrule democratic decisions made by locals. Why do these governors hate democracy? Because their corporate funders don't like some of the laws local people support. So democracy must go. This is not a matter of a rogue governor here or there, but a coordinated effort by corporate interests to get governors to usurp local authority. The main coordinator of this power grab is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. For example, in 2014, when Fight for 15 and other activist groups began winning city campaigns for minimum wage hikes, ALEC responded by holding a corporate forum on how state officials can stop such local actions. ALEC circulated a model bill called the Living Wage Preemption Act, and sure enough, it's already been passed by nearly half of our states. Ohio was the latest. By a large margin, people in the Buckeye State favor raising the wage floor, and Cleveland enacted its own increase last year. But a small group of corporate profiteers howled in fury. So last December, the state's Republican leaders rushed to appease them by adapting the ALEC preemption bill and ramming it into law. It was a political mugging of the people's will, retroactively negating Cleveland's increase and outlawing increases by any other locality. This is Jim Hightower saying, used sparingly and properly, preemption can be a democracy-enhancing tool to serve the common good. But when governors pervert this power to use it as a cudgel against the people, we the people must rise up against the governors. To learn more, visit mayorsinnovation.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the decades-old Mother Earth Fair. At 6, it's Rose Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, hot, but east of the Cascades, even a little hotter. Keep hydrated out there, folks. Today in history, in 1936, Jesse Owens won his first gold medal in the 100-meter dash, much to the consternation of Adolf Hitler, who had been planning to use the Berlin Olympics as an opportunity to display the superiority of the German people. Instead, he got to witness Jesse Owens, a black man, win 3 gold medals, thus crushing any kind of Aryan myth, but also he himself entering into the realm of legend. Owen stated that, quote, "When I came back to my native country, after all the stories about Hitler, I couldn't ride in the front of the bus. I had to go to the back door. I couldn't live where I wanted. I wasn't invited to shake hands with Hitler, but I wasn't invited to the White House to shake hands with the president either," end quote. The quote of the day is from Jesse Owens, quote, "The road to the Olympics leads to no city, no country. It goes far beyond New York or Moscow, ancient Greece or Nazi Germany. The road to the Olympics leads, in the end, to the best within us."
This afternoon, a city council meeting was held to consider 3 police oversight ordinances and resolutions dealing with the complaint review process, a new community-engaged policing committee, and the legality of disregarding the 48-hour rule, KABU reporter Sam Bowman is reporting live from City Hall. Hello, Sam.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, perfectly. So what's the scene like down there?
Well, we got here early at about 2:30. The hearing wasn't starting on these measures until 3:10, but we didn't get here early enough. It's actually, so we've been sitting in the overflow room called the Lovejoy Room for most of the time now. In there are about 20, 30 people, and council chambers are full, but the balcony has not been open to the public, and there's a lot of chatter. People think that that is where the police are probably sitting, on the assumption that there will be some rowdy interruptions, as there have been in the past.
Tell us a little bit about what's at stake here. What's going on?
So the council's considering three new ordinances relating to police oversight. One of them would create a Portland, I'm not sure exactly what it stands for, but it's called PCCEP. The CEP stands for Community Engagement Plan, and basically it's to replace the Community Oversight Advisory Board, which went defunct last year amid internal strife and such. But since that doesn't exist anymore, it puts the city out of compliance with the DOJ settlement agreement that it entered into in 2012. And so now they're trying to start this new community body to put them back into compliance. Another ordinance changes the grievance process through the independent police review, which is part of the city auditor's office, and it just kind of streamlines that a little bit. And the other one would do away with the infamous 48-hour rule, which said that police officers were required to be given 48 hours notice before they could be interviewed after shooting somebody fatally. And that has been one of the main points of contention so far during this meeting. But I should point out, they are just now getting to public testimony. It has been lawyers, people with the city, and the Reverends Bethel and Haynes from the Albina Ministerial Alliance so far, but that was all invited testimony.
I'm kind of curious about this, like, community review process. Like, who would that community be? Like, are there any kind of...
That's a very interesting question. So far, the community engagement plan has, as it is presented, and you can read about it by going to the council agenda and clicking on the exhibits for these ordinances, but it is so far to be appointed by the mayor's office, which is different from the way the oversight advisory board was set up, and it's also different from what a lot of people here would like to see, which is a thoroughly independent community oversight board with the power to make recommendations to the city, which currently doesn't exist and never really has.
And this 48-hour rule, so that basically says that an officer does not have to make a written statement for 48 hours after an incident with a gun, correct?
Well, they can't be compelled to make a statement to internal affairs. So that's the administrative investigation. That's like, you know, if somebody swears on the air at KABU, the administrative investigation would be to determine if they broke KABU's rules. In this case, to determine if the officer broke the police directives. The criminal investigation would be what the FCC looks at for us and what, you know, the police bureau looks at when they investigate that shooting as just a shooting. So currently the 48-hour rule as written is defunct. It was thrown out during the negotiations with the police union last year. But the in the meantime, the police have been using the excuse that if they are compelled to make statements to internal affairs, that could grant them immunity from a criminal prosecution, which, of course, as we've seen across the country and in several incidents in Portland itself, police officers are very rarely criminally indicted, so that's just letting them off the hook on two accounts, both within the police and within the general criminal laws of the country. Sorry, does that answer your question?
Yeah. We're kind of running out of a little time. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we go, Sam?
I would just like to add that there seems to be a general sense of mistrust in the city government here, even from the people within the government who have been interviewed so far invited to speak before the council. I don't know if he would agree with that characterization, but Constantine Severe spoke from the Independent Police Review, and he said that the city should really take ownership of their failure to properly dispose of the 48-hour rule. And he said that he's personally ashamed of their failure to do that. And so that's just one person within the city government, and that's not to say... I mean, people have
cut you off there. Sorry about that.
It's
nice talking to you. Thanks for calling in.
Absolutely. Bye.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Fox Wild Kunsel Dolma, Grace Ann Smith, Sam Bowman, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Zelos Marchand. Our engineer is Ben Shiregi. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 8, it's Voices from the Edge. Poet and activist John Slaughter welcomes Portland artists Mighty, Mike Capes, and more. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Eric Cascadia. Headlines, interview, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, talks to author Julie Israel about her new book, Juniper Lemon's Happiness Index, a story of grief, friendship, and secrets. At 11:30, Black Book Talk rebroadcasts its interview with Portland poet, actor, vocalist, and author Mario DePriest about his book, The Power of a Rose, what he calls an attempt to interject a calming breeze of romantic hope into a world of turbulence. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Great. I have in the studio Shauna Coronado, an author and green lifestyle evangelist. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. So I understand that there's going to be a really amazing fair happening.
It's in Albany, Oregon.
Albany.
It's at the Linn County Fairgrounds. And it's this Saturday and Sunday.
All right. So what
is the 5th and the 6th?
What can our Linn County community expect at the Mother Earth News Fair?
You know, we get people from all around the entire region that come in for this every year. It's such an exciting event because we have 150 speakers that come to the event. We have many stages where all the speakers rotate around and speak about different topics that are sustainable and green and really interesting. And then there's also a giant show, which is all the booths that might sell interesting green products, everything from herbs and honey and, you know, locally created things to items that are just really interesting for the organic kind of marketplace. And so one of my favorite items that are that's sold there every year is there's an ice cream place that sells dairy-free ice cream. Oh my gosh, you must come and eat your face off because it's so delicious. And then lunchtime is a treat there because every show that we have the food trucks come in. And so you're going to enjoy delicious food that's really local and unique. You're going to have all these amazing speakers, and I'm honored to be one of those speakers myself.
That's wonderful. Well, go into what kind of lectures people can catch. I understand that is one of the biggest draws, is that people get to meet and hear from over 100 different presenters.
Without a doubt. 150 people. And I mean, my gosh. And most of these people are authors. So you can just show up at a, you know, an event and have the opportunity to speak with a true expert about something. You can hear their speech, and then afterwards you can speak with them. Some of the topics that are happening, like I talk on gardening and wellness. Other people are talking about cheese making, animal husbandry, bread making, home distilling, growing and using your own herbs, like making soaps. So this is really something that can generate a lot of ideas for you as for your home and for your family. One of my favorite speeches, that anything to do with canning and learning how to process all those vegetables that are coming in right now, it's really important to know how to do it. And so coming to the Mother Earth News Fair is a great opportunity to get all the ins on and the secrets and the hacks for doing home processing and also learning more about sustainability.
Right on. So is there anything on pickling? I hear that's kind of becoming a more, it's coming back. Pickling's making a comeback.
It is. It is. I'm not sure if there's specifically anything on pickling, but anything that's fermented is really, kombucha is huge at these shows. And they'll have kombucha making classes. And then you can go into the booth area and you can usually find a group that's selling kombucha products so that you can learn how to make it at home yourself.
Oh.
And so I'm fascinated with it. Fermentation in general is supposed to be a very healthy way. If you eat fermented food, then it's supposed to be good for your system and the bacteria within your body. And so it used to be it was just sauerkraut, but now it's a whole wave of amazing vegetables and drinks and foods that you can use for with fermenting in mind.
I never thought of pickling and fermenting as separate because they're both sort of sour to me, but I guess they're different. I guess pickling just tastes sour and maybe doesn't do anything for you. And fermenting actually makes good bacteria, it sounds like, that you want in your body. Well,
the thing is, it all tastes good.
So. Right. You can see where my bottom line is. Does it taste good? Then we're fine. Oh, tell us about your lecture and your presentation some more.
You know, my favorite presentation that really gets a large audience is arthritis in the garden. I have severe degenerative osteoarthritis, and with diet and exercise, I've reduced my pain down by 85%. Essentially,
wow.
I teach my audience, here's what you need to do to reduce your chronic pain, and here's how I can help you. And so it's a combination, of course, of gardening techniques, but it's also diet. And so the big portion at the beginning of my speech, I talk about the diet that I'm on and how it's really saved my life. And I feel like $1 million. And 2 years ago when I was first diagnosed, I never could have predicted that. So it's really a joy to come to these shows and inspire people to do good and to also feel better every day.
Do you ever get pushback using the word diet? It seems to have, I mean, I think naturally it has a really dark connotation with people that stems back to self-hate, and people are, you know, usually imagining that they're going to be just starving themselves. Can you maybe help our listeners know that they may not be starving?
I use the word because I'm really consuming no grain and no dairy.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's, you know, in anyone's vernacular, you know, that's really a diet of sorts. But this is a lifestyle choice. I am permanently on these foods that I use, and this is what's reduced the pain levels that I have. Mm. But I'll tell you, I thought that I would be starving myself, like you said, when you say diet, you know, I'm going to be eating 1,000 calories a day. It's going to be horrifying. And instead, it's been delicious. you know, all the foods that I can eat are fresh. Somewhere around the 6-month mark on this diet, this food consumption, you know, I really discovered something amazing, which is my taste returned. I love the taste of herbs. I love food. Before, I thought I loved it, but it didn't taste as good. Huh. I think there's something amazing that happens when you get rid of the grains, get rid of sugar, and instead focus on eating good vegetables, good meats, good proteins, things that are really delicious for you. And with no prescriptions, I am now off of all my prescription medications. So I don't take prescriptions, and instead I eat good food. So my theory is that food is the cure.
Oh, wow. That's really profound. I do think there's something to once your body gets what it needs, if it can get it, then it is able to then give energy to things like taste buds and mm-hmm. happy moods.
Well, I think coming to the show, you'll discover a lot of people like me. And I love the speakers. We always get together after the show events to compare notes and to help one another and what have you. And what we've found is that almost all of us, particularly in the food category, are talking about healthy, nutritious, no chemicals, a better lifestyle, and doing it with ease. And I think it's a powerful thing to come together with real people who are living these lifestyles and can inspire others.
How long, out of curiosity, did it take to, after you changed the way you eat, changed your lifestyle, for the mm-hmm. pain to decrease to a point where you noticed it, and then to a point where you realized, wow, this is actually an 80% improvement?
A huge difference, yes. So the first week, my nutritionist, I consulted with a nutritionist. She's certified and very talented, and she put me on for the first 30 days, it was no grains, no dairy, and no sugar. And I did this for the first 30 days. Within 4 days, I could sleep again because I hadn't been sleeping at all. I had such extreme pain. So within the first 4 days, so I'm telling you, within a week, you would notice a significant difference. And within about 3 weeks, I went off of all my high blood pressure meds. I'd been taking blood pressure meds for 20 years, and I no longer needed them because my blood pressure went back to normal.
Mm.
And the real secret is I do this, you know, I eat a special way, but I also walk every day. I walk 1 hour every day, and I think that the combination of those two things really helped my blood pressure situation. And the other big change that I noticed, like within 6 months, my pain had gone down considerably more. You know, I would say more closer to, like, you know, 50 or 60% of my pain had receded. And then my allergies started to lessen. I had severe allergies, like year-round bronchitis all the time. And by consuming proper foods, I noticed that, you know, my sinuses felt better. Generally speaking, it's an anti-inflammatory diet. So you're reducing inflammation in your sinuses and in your body, and reduced inflammation means reduced diabetes, heart disease, all of these things that are giant problems in our culture right now. And so I think that focusing on some good food makes a big difference in a short period of time.
Tipping my cap to you about the walking 1 hour a day, because low impact, I think, doesn't get enough credit. The low impact effort their bodies put out, that some people will go, oh, well, that's, what is that walking? But that really does compound, from what I understand.
Oh, totally agree.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So agree. And I do, because I was one of those people before that felt you had to kill yourself in the gym in order to
guilty.
Produce, right?
Guilty.
Yeah, you must look like Arnold Schwarzenegger in order to
of
be
course.
Healthy. And that is so not true. You know, what you really need is consistent daily exercise. It doesn't have to be overly strenuous. The 1 hour a day has been remarkable for me. In fact, when I was diagnosed, I had a really, and I'm an outdoors person. I was always gardening and all of that. But I had a pulse rate of 90 beats per minute. Remember, when you start walking, I wanted to start tracking that and making sure I was healthier. Now I'm at 70 beats per minute 2 years later. Mm. It's only with walking that I've done this. There's no miraculous, you know, gymnastic, you know, routine that I do. I like yoga because I like the stretching, but I have osteoarthritis, and it's proven that stretching isn't really good for runners to improve their running. It's been scientifically proven that it doesn't really make a difference for runners. But where it does make a difference is for people like me who have osteoarthritis and have joint range problems. Mm. And so I thought that this was an old person's disease. And the number one person who's reached out to me are like people that are under the age of 40 who have had rheumatoid mm-hmm. arthritis diagnosis and don't know how to live with the pain. Mm. And the secret is to reduce inflammation. Doing it without a medication makes much more sense than doing it with the medication, becoming addicted to opioids, for instance.
We
don't want pain medications. We want to find a natural solution for this.
And I wish my mom was listening.
Make her listen.
Well, I would, you know, the anti-inflammation.